Welcome to the Math Factor for the first time in maybe almost a year. It's nice to do another piece. I have the rare and unusual privilege of having two great puzzlers in Fayetteville, Arkansas on the very same day by some astounding, one would be above quota, and so two is fantastic. We have Ed Pegg of a number of things, but mathpuzzle.com, and Jimmy Stevens of also a number of things, but puzzlebeast.com. And so welcome to Fayetteville.
Yeah, thank you, Grant.
Thanks for having us.
It's kind of strange having you both here at the same time, so I'm really glad that worked out. So on the table here is one of Jimmy Stevens' new puzzles, Antivirus. You want to?
Yeah, this is a puzzle that Oscar van de Venter and I developed together. It was actually originally Oscar's idea, and he came up with he sent me a sketch actually of just sort of a general concept of some pieces, some square pieces hooked together, sometimes along their sides and sometimes along their diagonals to make larger pieces, and then incorporating that in a sliding block puzzle. And he and I spent a lot of time going back and forth on the design, finally came up with the design you see here, which has the more sort of the curved look to the pieces.
So these are sort of, it's on a grid, these are sort of circular pieces that are arranged in kind of a square lattice grid.
For the radio audience, you can find it on puzzlebeast.com, a puzzle called Bulbous Blob, and you can try the puzzle online there.
So it's a lot like Rush Hour, say, but turned 45 degrees.
It's similar in the sense that it's a sliding block. There's no constraint in terms of the movement of the pieces, except that they have to move along the grid, so you can move them sideways, you know, front and back, or sideways.
I was invited here for a conference, and I decided I would bring one puzzle with me. And so I pulled out my favorite, which is Antivirus. I had no idea that James Steffens was going to actually be here at the same time. But this is a very good puzzle. I highly recommend it.
So just sort of back to the beginning, in a sense, what got you interested in, when did you first really realize you were deeply interested in puzzles? I imagine as kids, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep,
what kinds of things?
Martin Gardner's column.
Yeah, exactly. I did the same. I remember in middle school in the 70s reading every Martin Gardner book I could find in the library, and then sitting down and I remember making the little his little binary encoder decoder out of cardboard. Actually, a few years ago, I was cleaning out some stuff in my parents' basement and found some shredded pieces of that. You know.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was of course a major influence for me as well. That's funny, isn't it?
Eight, I remember playing with pentominoes that I'd managed to find at a obscure store. And then I had, because I'd seen them in Gardner's column and I wanted a set every set. I've never got around to actually making a set myself. I wanted to buy one.
Was that there was a toy that was actually a pentomino kit that was actually fairly popular, I guess, in the late 60s, early 70s? Maybe it was that one. It was a tray with the pentominoes in it?
Lines in it in the plastic, so it also made a maze.
Oh, wow. I didn't remember that one. What are some of the kinds of things you've worked on over the years? What are some of your favorite projects?
For me, the Numbers TV show, Math World, and the MAA columns. Which is quite a bad.
All still exist, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, if you look on puzzlebeast.com, I have a number of puzzles I've worked on. Actually, to me, the most fun thing was a project I worked on with Andrea Gilbert, who does Click Mazes, clickmazes.com. And the first program I ever wrote was she had developed the Plank puzzles, which since have been marketed by Think Fun under the title River Crossing.
Oh, River Crossing.
But they're brilliant puzzles, and to me they really encapsulate the epitome of sort of a very elegant puzzle with simple rules that leads to huge complexity and really some neat challenges. And I actually got started on writing, I write computer programs to generate puzzles, to sort of encode rules and then look for interesting puzzles. And I got started in it because I played all of Andrea's puzzles online and got frustrated because there weren't any more to play. So
you had to do them yourself.
So I thought, well, let me see if I can write some software to generate them. Interestingly enough, the first thing I did was I tried writing something in Perl and found it was way too slow, but ended up moving to Java because I like quick and dirty programming, and it had acceptable speed for me. And learned a lot in that process, learned a lot about what makes puzzles interesting. So to me, that was probably the most satisfying thing about it, was that first software.
And I promoted the Plank puzzles and introduced Andrea to Bill Ritchie at ThinkFun, and as a result of that meeting, the puzzle got made.
That's cool. Yeah, I guess I was just reading in one of Ivers Peterson's columns that he wrote about Tipover being MP complete. Tipover is another one of your puzzles, and I guess in that same column he also discusses
Bob Hearn's work. Yeah.
Right, Bob Hearn. Mm-hmm. Is he now at Dartmouth or MIT?
He is in...
somewhere else.
He was in Vancouver now.
Vancouver. Anyway, he, I guess, had proven a number of things about all those puzzles. Tipover, I guess, did very well, didn't it?
I think it seems to.
Games Magazine Puzzle of the Year?
Exactly. Yes, as Antivirus was as well.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, thank you. I was surprised with that, by both of them. I think Tipover, the thing that turned out really nice about Tipover was just that, you know, knocking over the crates is fun. So
making a mess.
Yeah. I mean, it was funny. I developed Tipover really with specifically the idea that I was trying to think of sort of a movement or an action in puzzles that had not been used or exploited before. Uh-huh. And so there are rolling block puzzles, but you keep rolling blocks around. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, how about if you only get one chance at it, you just knock it over. So, apparently, from what I've heard, kids really like going in and just set them up and just knocking them down.
Well, one thing that really interests me, we were discussing yesterday, and I really wanted to explore this a little bit more. What makes a good puzzle? You just had touched on that, but what are some of the
something that will provide a mental challenge for you? For a sufficient amount of time for you to actually solve it.
So it's not impossible.
Right, so it can't be impossible, and to be really good, it has to sustain your interest long enough that you actually get to the solution.
Interestingly, I was thinking about this after our discussion yesterday, and it's funny, but you know, probably the most popular puzzle ever, actually, I think fails in many respects in that, which is Rubik's Cube, because it's so darn hard. Mm-hmm. And I actually think puzzles are the most interesting puzzles are the ones where you sort of you have a set of states that you can visit. You have some aspect of the puzzle, whether it's that you have a certain number of pieces put together, or that you can visit some particular set of states in a multi-state puzzle. Whatever that is, and then you discover something, and then you move to another set of states. And then I think that sort of tends to keep people's interest. If it's just this sort of bewildering group of where you have to find some magic route from here to there, which I think for most people, unless they really get serious with Rubik's Cube, that's the case.
Well, another thing is a puzzle is very good when it's fiddly, if you can play with it a long time. For example, there's a lot of take-apart puzzles where taking it apart is easy, but putting it back together is very difficult.
And we have a bunch of those in the math lounge. Guess which step we're in.
Often with those, the fun part is taking it apart. Uh-huh. And if it only takes 30 seconds, you really have no idea what you just did. And the whole fun of the puzzle is now gone.
Right.
One puzzle I helped get developed was Gordian's Knot.
Yeah, that's in fact in pieces in the math lounge.
Oh, if they managed to take it apart? Yeah. Well, you can play with that for a long time and not take it apart, which makes it very good for fiddling around with. And Rubik's Cube is the same way. You can you can mess with it for a long time, and it's still in a pristine stage, sort of, because it's not in a tedious stage. One example of a bad puzzle is a box of broken glass. That's really hard. That's really hard to put back together, and painful and nasty. And there's no pleasure at all in putting together this box of broken glass.
Right. Well, it's an I guess that touches on something that I was really interested in. So I guess with a state, a bag of broken glass, right, the number of states is just phenomenal, right? The number of things, like the search tree has just got zillions of branches out.
And it may not be solvable if there's enough powder in the box.
Right. But, and you were discussing, you know, that there's some constraints. I mean, that the search is somewhat constrained, that you try out a number of things, and you reach a new state, and you're satisfied, you know that's, mm-hmm. and you can move further and further. I was playing around a lot with various puzzles that were created by people at Nikolai. Let's just take, say, Slitherlink or something. And all the Nikolai puzzles that they publish are handcrafted.
Right.
And at the same time, for example, for the iPhone or something, you can find plenty of computer-generated Nikolai-type puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real different quality, I think. I mean, I feel, and I wanted to ask you about this, that they're not the computer-generated ones tend not to be as satisfying. It's different than the way you use computers. I think there's a qualitative difference in the way the search space. So, for example, the handcrafted ones, there's an idea, right? In the Nikolai puzzles, mm-hmm. there's some concept, and it's very satisfying to sort of see the mind mm-hmm. of the author revealed. But the computer-generated Nikolai-type puzzles, the search space is just so vast and arbitrary and crazy that there is a solution, but it's not humanly appealing.
Right. It depends on whether or not you can have a good computer-generated puzzle. If you say make five of them and have a human pick out which one is the best, and that's how many of the ThinkFund puzzles are developed. They'll develop thousands of puzzles, and they're all evaluated, and people will pick out ones which are actually good puzzles. I believe there are some Nikolai puzzles that were computer generated. They were just very carefully picked, and sometimes you'll tweak a puzzle several times before it's in an acceptable form.
I spend a lot of my time when I'm developing puzzles tweaking the algorithm. I mean, sort of in a nutshell, the way that, you know, Tipover and Antivirus and Hotspot, which was another ThinkFund puzzle, the way those were developed was once I had the ideas for the rules, the rules were encoded, and then I had wrote software that would randomly generate puzzles, score them in some fashion, and then randomly mutate them and pick the highest score. Well, it turns out that there are two aspects of that are crucial to getting things that are interesting out of it. The first off is how you generate the randomly generate them. Mm-hmm. Some things it works fine just to do it completely randomly. Other times it's random but with some parameters that give you a better chance of getting something that's interesting. And then the biggest issue is how you score it, and you have mm-hmm. to come up with some kind of algorithm that's actually going to be predictive of whether it's a playable puzzle. And so for a lot of things that actually makes a huge difference. Tipover, for example, will generate, if you just completely do it randomly and use a trivial method of scoring, it generates a lot of really crashingly boring challenges.
I wonder too if there's are really constrained games too, mm-hmm. though. I'm sorry.
Yeah, one thing that makes Antivirus really good is there's usually only a few pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
For example, this is a sliding block puzzle with only four pieces, and many of the challenges only have three pieces.
Right.
You can see really far with your mind what's going to happen when you've only got that limited number of pieces. There are some puzzles that have 50 or 100 or thousands of pieces. Those, it's very hard to get a good glimpse as to what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Your Tipover, Antivirus are very highly constrained, very small playing fields. The space is different. Like mm-hmm. with these Slitherlink examples, for example, that I was bringing up. Yeah, I mean, it's this vast board, and there's how the hell is it all
connected
up?
Yeah, it depends on the size you're dealing with. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, getting back to sort of the satisfying aspects, I mean, one of the things I'm most proud of is, although I almost feel like I can't take credit because I feel like the software did it, which in this case is probably really true, and that was finding a new sliding block puzzle that had never been apparently had never been discovered before, that only has four pieces on a 4x4 grid. That actually turns out to be, I think, a fairly interesting puzzle. Mm-hmm. And when I found it, I just assumed, how could this be? I mean, it's, you know, four pieces. There's two 2x1 pieces, and then two sort of three-block L-shaped pieces.
Is that commercially available, or it's on...
it's not.
It's on Puzzle Beast.
Yeah, it's on Puzzle Beast, called Simplicity. I'm hoping somebody will... if anybody's listening and like the market. But I think, to me, it was just amazing that this thing sort of appeared out of the ether, you know. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I feel like I discovered it rather than invented it.
The Gordian's Knot puzzle was kind of the same way. They searched through billions of puzzles trying to find the ultimate burr puzzle, and this one just kind of rose above all the others. It takes, I forget how many moves to take apart, but it was so tricky and interwoven compared to everything else that had ever been discovered before, that it was just kind of a magical discovery, really.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And made one of the best fiddly puzzles ever made. So we can have Haim solve one of these puzzles here.
In real time?
Yeah.
Well, I think the listeners might have to sit and listen listen to this for... They can hear some clicking.
Clack, clack, clack.
So one thing that's really nice about antivirus is it's just so tactily, appealing, you know.
Yeah,
tactily.
Well, I think a lot of that was thanks to Oscar, and his wavy board design was his idea, and I think it's just brilliant.
A word about Oscar is he's the foremost mechanical puzzle creator in the world. You can see some of his puzzles at Oscar, with a K, Oscar Puzzle on YouTube, and he designs a new puzzle that's phenomenal just about once every 3 days.
Yeah, I think he does it in his sleep. It's just incredible how much he generates.
From what I've heard, he will actually think up a puzzle in his head and finish it there, and then he'll put it into a CAD program and now send it to Shapeways for 3D printing.
Yeah, he had, I guess, the 17 by 17 by 17 Rubik's Cube.
Yes.
Which is phenomenal looking.
Yeah, and it's actually functional, but so far no mathematician has figured out how many shapes that thing can be.
Yeah, right.
Well, he also, a lot of the Haneyama has a number of his puzzles in metal. Really, some really elegant stuff.
Yeah, one thing to search for is the Cast series, which are excellent metal puzzles.
Cast? Yeah. C-A-S-T?
Yeah. Cast series is what it's called.
Yeah, I've seen those in Barnes & Noble recently.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you can find them on Amazon.
Are they, what kind of puzzle are they?
Yeah. They're usually two-piece metal puzzles.
Oh, the kind of
typically take-apart
puzzles?
Yeah.
So let me just touch on that. So, can you rattle off some of your favorite puzzles in addition to your own for the listeners? And designers and...
Anything by Haneyama, or the Cast series.
How do you spell Haneyama?
Haneyama.
Oh, that's okay.
If I remember right.
Yeah, this, I love the Haneyama stuff. Of course, Rush Hour has got to be a favorite. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, and in terms of the ultimate fiddly puzzle.
Anything by ThinkFun is usually pretty good.
Yeah.
Or Smart Games is pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to think back on other favorite puzzles.
And there's also the classics, pentominoes, hexominoes, polyforms in general. A great free program is Burr Tools, where you can play with a lot of puzzles. It's a free program, you can build them yourself. Do a look for sliding block puzzles. The number one site is going to be John Roush's Puzzle World, and that has a big... a large number of sliding block puzzles there. Puzzlebeast.com, of course, has a lot of good ones. Click Mazes by Andrea Gilbert. Mm-hmm. Logic Mazes by Robert Abbott.
Oh, yes.
My site, Math Puzzle, has links to many more.
I have to slip in Nikolai.
Nikolai for pencil and paper puzzles,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, what do you think, it was interesting, we were touching a little bit on sort of there's physical puzzles, there's pencil and paper puzzles, there are computer or iPhone puzzles. What do you think of the strengths or weaknesses of those?
That's a great question.
It depends on what day it is. I really like pencil and paper puzzles a lot when I'm traveling, because they're in a constrained space. Another one I should mention is Art of Puzzles by the Grabarchuk family, and they just recently came up with something called Strimco, which is on many devices. And that's an excellent Sudoku variant. It's worth mentioning Sudoku. It was developed by an engineer by the name of Howard Garnes in Indianapolis. And we had the Will Shorts was one to track down the original discoverer, because that was in a Dell puzzle column in the 1970s. And his name was listed in the back every time a Sudoku puzzle appeared. It wasn't called Sudoku back then, it was called Number Place. And a person from Nikolai saw the Dell puzzles.
So it wasn't independent, it was...
Right, they saw it in Dell, and oh, this is a good one. We can't call it Number Place, though. We'll come up with our own name.
So what's Sudoku mean in...
It means
number
there
place?
Can only be... one is the number, basically one in each. Uh-huh. It used to have a much longer name, and they shortened it down to Sudoku. So they took a copyright on Sudoku in Japan, and that's how they started it there. And people started copying it in Japan. Number Place hadn't been copyrighted in Japan, so they started calling it Number Place there. And over here in the United States, Number Place had been copyrighted. So the copiers called it Sudoku because wasn't copyrighted as Sudoku anywhere but Japan. And in Japan now, it's called, if you're copying it, it's called Latin Squares, because there are copyright issues with both Number Place and Sudoku in Japan.
That's crazy.
So it's got the Japanese name here and it's got the American name in Japan, for the most part.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Oh, you're real.
I appreciate y'all taking the time to stop
thanks
by and
for
talk.
Having us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be sure to check out your puzzles.
Well, thanks for having us.
Well, that was the end of the interview, we thought. But the fact is, we really couldn't stop talking. So here's the rest of our conversation of a slightly more technical nature. Okay. Thank you. This is great. I really am really interested in the topic of the question of measuring complexity of solvability, you know.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that.
I mean, it's clearly some sort of state space, you know, and you're wandering around inside of it, and there's some notion of what's a satisfying state space to wander around in and what's not, you know.
Yeah. For a small multi-state maze, I think it's marvelous when you get lost in that, because you know you can't be too lost because you're in this really small space.
Well, that might be what's true about
things
like this, yeah.
Whereas if I gave you a really big multi-state maze,
right,
you would, like some of the Klondike puzzles perhaps, it's not really too multi-state, but... there are some of those where it's so obvious that you're so far off the base that you can just give up. So it's good to have it's good to be completely lost. People like that sensation.
I think that actually gets close to what was irritating me about the computer-generated Nikolai-style puzzles, is that you're in this, you don't know how far away from the correct state
right.
you mm-hmm. are. You know, like if you have a randomly generated Mirakabi puzzle or something, you know, the number of possible ways of filling in the squares is 2 to the 10 by
right,
N or something, and you could be really far off and not have a clue if...
It's not just complexity per se, but also structure. And
yeah.
There has to be some kind of, and I don't know, that's just a different definition of complexity.
But
if you're trying to solve it logically, sometimes with a computer-generated puzzle, it's not solvable logically, because the computer will just keep trying things
right.
until it comes up with a solution. And if it's a unique solution, sometimes that's good enough to publish.
I think that's right.
Whereas if you're trying to figure this thing out logically and you're doing marks down, you get to a place where you have to make a total wild guess. If you guess wrongly, then you've got to do a lot of backtracking and sometimes
right.
restart the puzzle entirely if you've got a lot of marks down.
Right. And I really dislike guessing in those puzzles.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's very unsatisfying.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, well, and I think the other piece is that a lot of times the most satisfying puzzles have at least one part that you can't get to logic, I mean, your linear thought You know, mm-hmm. you have to have a discontinuity, but it can't be too big.
Right.
It has to be big enough that you go, aha, oh, wait a second, this is a totally different thing. And now, mm-hmm. But if it takes 20 moves to get to there, then it's probably not satisfying. If there's four or five moves, and then you realize, and it's clear at that point, well, I've made a breakthrough and I've gotten to another place, then I think it's very satisfying.
And for example, with the sliding block puzzle, you can figure out that one piece will never be able to get past another piece in a certain direction. Unless perhaps something happens, and then you try to get that something to happen.
Yeah. I think as I was saying yesterday too, you know, it's amazing if you just look at the complexity of just a simple two-dimensional maze on paper and try to think and try to come up with an algorithm that's going to predict whether or not it's an interesting maze to solve and whether it's challenging. It's remarkably difficult. And you can come up with all sorts of stuff in terms of, you know, the amount of branching and the length of the solution, mm-hmm. and you can come up with all those sorts of measures, and then you'll still find that when you apply that, and I did this years ago, but if you apply that to a maze, that you'll still come up with examples where you go, oh, wait, you know, you can't go that way, mm-hmm. you know, because the topologies means that you just blocked off a whole set of mm-hmm. paths or something like that. And you keep trying to think, and then you realize that there's all sorts of psychological things in terms of parallel paths and all that kind of stuff. And
so you're speaking of like just plain old mazes, right?
Yeah, it's plain
old like mazes, something like that.
Well, the Nikolai puzzles, exactly. The mazes are somewhat specialized in that it's now considered mandatory for Japanese mazes to show a picture.
Yeah, right.
When you've colored in the
so
path
you have
correctly.
A big clue, I guess, is your after at some point. It looks like a panda.
Yes. Uh huh. And then the puzzle is basically two parts to figure out what the picture is of.
Right.
One thing I
like about, like, so this is Puzzle Communications, or no, you know, one of their Nikolai mm-hmm. magazines. And it's entirely in Japanese. And one of the puzzles, I like the meta puzzle of trying to figure out what the hell the rules are.
Right.
Because, you know, Nikolai puzzles have to have satisfying rules. They have to have rules that make sense and have a unique solution. So looking at...
Well, it's not all in Japanese. There's often a lot of pictures that explain the puzzles. And usually the pictures are enough for you to know what the rules are.
I found that there's some ambiguity sometimes. And one I worked, you know, really thought I had worked out, and it didn't match the back. And turned out, of course, I had to do it the kanji that are all over the puzzle.
Okay.
So you have to actually know something.
Well, this, I think, gets to a difference between the different styles of puzzles, too. You can have, for example, you can have an iPhone puzzle that has some complicated rules, and as long as it's not too complicated, the solver just sort of has to be able to keep up with the rules. They don't have to really remember them. They have to be simple enough that they make sense when the app, you know, enforces it on the person. But for something like this, for a physical puzzle, I mean, the rules really have to be simple enough that that they're maybe not intuitive, but pretty close to. I think
all of these puzzles are almost like that. I mean, you're just so highly constrained. But with the physical puzzles, right, you obviously, as you say, you can't even slide it in an illegal direction. But even for, like, these paper and pencil puzzles, the rules aren't much more complex. You know, it'd be pretty boring if...
Right, you don't want to have complex rules because otherwise you won't have depth. That's one important thing in puzzles. You have to be able to see several moves in advance in order to have some appreciation of it. If you've got basically there are some mechanical puzzles where all you hear is rattling in a box. You can't see what's going on.
Yeah, I hate those.
And Martin Gardner once talked about a particularly hard version of this type, uh-huh. and the person finally X-rayed it so he could see what was inside, and there's all sorts of hidden magic, hidden magnets and plungers that had to be activated in certain ways.
Yeah, maddening.
With the X-ray, he was able to solve it in a couple of days. But just rattling around, there was no depth to that, so it wasn't a good puzzle as well.
Yeah, Oscar is a master at this. I understand his philosophy of puzzles is that they should be self-evident. You should be able to pick up an Oscar mm-hmm. puzzle and know what needs to be done without having to be told. So the There's really no rules. And he's great at developing these puzzles where just the physical shape enforces the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the rules may actually be fairly complicated, and you look at it, you go, well, gee, I can figure this out because, mm-hmm. you know, two pieces can't intersect one
mm-hmm.
another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly a violation of physics.
But he's Oscar's kind of the Euler of mechanical puzzles. He's,
yeah.
He's so far beyond anybody else, it's scary.
And now with Shapeways, he's just really zooming
mm-hmm.
zooming off.
Mm-hmm.
You were mentioning music yesterday. To me, there's an analogy. I don't know how far I'd want to push this analogy, but and if you look at the development of music starting with some of the earlier forms of music and moving to the sonata form, and there was this process by which composers discovered that they can make music continue to be interesting even for longer pieces. And I think there's a perfect analogy there. A good puzzle actually should follow the sonata form almost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really, you have these themes that are running through it. There's a relationship between them. If you had a symphony that was 90 minutes long or 60 minutes long, and there was no structure to it, even if the music changed, even if the theme
right.
changed, it wouldn't keep your interest for very long.
Yeah.
I think it's similar with puzzles.
One example of that is puzzle competitions are usually broken up into different puzzles. Like, for example, the crossword tournament was just held in by Will Shorts recently. They didn't have one gigantic 90,000 by 90,000 crossword to solve. It was chunks of 10 different crossword puzzles.
Right.
Having just one wouldn't have been nearly as interesting. And for various puzzle contests, they'll usually be, for example, the penny hunt puzzles at MIT. And you can see these online. The MIT yearly has a yearly puzzle that dates back, I think, 30 years now. It's usually a packet of 15 different puzzles. There's usually a theme connecting them all, but you basically have to solve each of these different puzzles in order to get to the final answer, which in MIT is where the hidden penny is,
mm-hmm.
somewhere on campus.
Yeah, and a lot of times, I don't know about those particular puzzles, but a lot of times if you see puzzles that are broken up that way, you can also, if you solve one, it'll give you information. You can
yes, uh-huh.
solve another one.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, because you know the solutions have to all fit together to
mm-hmm.
form
right.
sort of the ultimate solution.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this all points to the last couple of things we talked about on the podcast nearly a year ago. You know, the ubiquity of how small, simple constraints, how small, simple rules can basically open up to a universe of complexity and intractability. You know, that even within these tiny, tiny systems, you know, that you can keep people occupied for hundreds or thousands of hours.
Yeah, it's been something of a fascination of mine. And one of the reasons I like doing the generating puzzles by, you know, coding them up into software is that if I get an idea for rules, I can fairly quickly find out how much complexity there is there. Because you code up the rules into a Java program and turn mm-hmm. it on, and if suddenly it starts spitting out puzzles that take, you know, 100 or 200 steps to solve, you know there's a lot of complexity. You don't
mm-hmm.
necessarily know at that point how interesting it is, but you know that there's at least a lot
mm-hmm.
of,
mm-hmm.
there may be a lot of interesting space to, and I'm surprised a lot of times I'll come up with ideas and think, wow, surely this is going to come up with something really neat, and I encode it, and then I discover in playing it that, oh yeah, I see why it doesn't do anything very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Sort of the whole thing fizzles out when you try to.
I mean, that's really maybe the most interesting aspect of all, right? That sort of the meta puzzle of these elegant, simple systems, simple sets of rules that give rise to this universe.
Right. There's often something hidden. Whenever you've got any sort of constraint, there's usually something hidden in there somewhere that's really deep mathematically.
Uh-huh.
For example, you can take a simple polynomial like x to the third minus 6x squared plus 4x minus 2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the roots of that polynomial to the 24th power matches e to the square root
oh, yeah.
of 163 to 32 decimal places.
Right.
And that's one of the deepest results in mathematics. And it links up with something called the monster group in group theory and the Conway's moonshine conjecture. And these are really, really deep results, but you don't realize it when you're just simple looking at the simple polynomial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of Bob Hearn's work on analyzing some of the simple puzzles I find fascinating. The math, I'm not a mathematician, so the math is beyond me for most of it, but I think it's fun. You know, you take something like Rush Hour, which is, on the surface of it, is incredibly simple. I actually don't think I would have had the guts if I had been thinking and trying to come up with puzzles to take something with as trivial rules as Rush Hour. I mean, you can't even move the car sideways, you know, it's just forward and backwards, and there are only two kinds of cars. Well,
but it's the equivalent, the Rush Hour sliding block puzzle is equivalent to a computer because you can build logic circuits in it. Same with tip-over. They've developed circuits for tip-over. So it's basically equivalent to a computer, which means it can basically do anything efficiently.
Really amazing. Course, you can program in tip over.
Which I wouldn't recommend, though.
it's really large boards.
But that's also true of virtually all of these, I should add. You know, like Minesweeper, Sudoku, most of the Nikolai games have now been shown. And I get, you know, and on and on and on. They all have the same kind of characteristic that you can essentially program inside of them, but incredibly inefficiently.
Right,
but nonetheless.
If you want to play around with computer circuits in a non-electrical thing, one thing to look at is the cellular automaton by the name of Wire World, which you can play around with in the program GALLI, which is free.
Which is an amazing, amazing program.
And they managed to fit a Wire World computer, which does multiplication in a block less than 20 by 80, and that will multiply 2 8-digit numbers together. And all the circuitry is built right into the and is built right into this block of ones and zeros, basically.
That's cool.
But once again, I think that the things that turn out to be interesting are the ones that have that structure. I mean,
right.
You can generate a lot of things that have very simple rules that generate
right.
massive complexity, whether there's some portion of the space that's interesting or not is a whole other question.
Right.
On a cellular automata, a puzzle where every time you touch something, like for example, lights out, where everything that's around where you touch changes, if the changes are much more random than that, there's no depth to it. Wire World, you can basically see what's going to happen really far, and that also makes it a good computer. But also randomness will eliminate the possibility that you can replicate a computer with it. And one thing you'll notice in many good puzzles is with some constructions you'll be able to build logic circuits. Many of the best puzzles are equivalent to computers.
Right. That's cool. Very cool, actually. Very deep too.
Although, as Bob Hearn pointed out to me, tip-over is not as complicated as Rush Hour, is not as complex as Rush Hour because his simple explanation is because eventually you tip over all the crates.
Yes,
well, you can
even I can understand that.
Because to search a solution in tip-over is just, it's done, right? Essentially. And Rush Hour, the solution is a long, lengthy list of instructions. That's another way to put it. Well, thanks again. And I have to go teach, so
I guess we'll just follow you in class and talk to you in there.